Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. When David Axelrod was a young boy, he was inspired by a young candidate for president who campaigned on a platform of youth and new ideas for a new generation. It was 1960. The candidate was John F. Kennedy. David Axelrod was just 5 years old, but Kennedy had a profound impact and inspired him to get involved in politics, where he spent the last four decades. His biggest job, masterminding the successful presidential campaign of Barack Obama in 2008, and then a successful re-election campaign 4 years later. Now he's out with a new memoir about those campaigns, about politics, about his life and the Obama White House. It's called Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. And David Axelrod is with me now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation with David Axelrod, former senior strategist to President Obama. What's your question about the Obama presidency, about the Obama White House, and what makes the president tick? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. David, I'd love to start by just asking you about that JFK moment on the campaign trail that inspired you. You write that you became hooked. You wanted to be a part of the action. What grabbed you about that?
Well, you know, the story is that I was at home in my apartment at this housing development in New York, Stuyvesant Town, where I lived. My mother was at work, and this woman who took care of me when she was at work, an African-American woman named Jessie Berry, wonderful, wise woman, thought I should go out and see this. She put me on a mailbox on 20th Street in Manhattan, and the place, it's a very busy boulevard filled with cars usually, and now it was filled with people. And this very charismatic man jumped up on a platform and started speaking, and people watched him with rapt attention, and his voice was booming off of the buildings around him, and it was clear he was talking about something important. I was five. I didn't know exactly what it was, but it was about the country and the future, and it was just a magnetic kind of scene for me, and that really got me started. And I think about it all the time for a number of reasons, but one of them is that that woman, Jessie Berry, who took me there, I think about what she would have thought about the young man who, the little boy she put on that mailbox and ending up working for the first African-American president.
Well, and that's a great transition because JFK, of course, represented a major generational shift, a potentially transformative figure. The same could be said of Barack Obama. He ran on the promise of sort of wholesale change in our political culture. I know that you would argue that he's accomplished a lot, but arguably he's fallen short of being able to deliver that promise of wholesale political change.
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. The one thing that I would say is that wholesale political change was not the goal in and of itself. Wholesale political change was the vehicle to bring about substantive change on a wide variety of issues. And his fundamental point was we have to stop focusing on the next election and start focusing on the next generation. And I think to an extent, beyond any president in recent years, he's done that. And when you look at where we were then when he arrived and where we are now on a wide number of issues, you know, whether it was the state of the economy, which was in near collapse at the time, versus where we are today, health care. We had two wars raging at the time, 180,000 troops overseas, you know, the status of gays and lesbians in a much different place, Cuba, immigration reform, a whole range of things fundamentally different today because you had a president who was willing to take them on.
What isn't fundamentally different, though, and I know that this must keep the president up at night, I'm sure it keeps you up at night, is this sort of toxic relationship in Washington and the kind of the political gridlock in Washington. I think the president had hopes that he could somehow penetrate that.
Yeah.
He hasn't been able to. Is that the biggest sort of unfulfilled piece of business?
I think it's a big disappointment. There's no doubt. I wrote about this in the book. You know, we had high hopes, especially because the country seemed to really embrace the notion of a greater spirit of cooperation in Washington. And, you know, the president acted on that belief during the campaign, in the midst of the campaign, when Lehman Brothers collapsed and George Bush asked for a the TARP program to keep the financial industry from collapsing. It was Obama who led the Democrats in the midst of his election campaign to support Bush. We thought that given the fact that the economy continued to worsen and we entered office with this economic catastrophe on our hands, we would find bipartisan cooperation. But, Anthony, what happened was we swept in large Democratic majorities, and I think Mitch McConnell, very, very shrewd politician, made a very pragmatic judgment, and you can make your own value judgment about it, which was let them handle these problems. They've got the votes to do it. Why should we put our signature on what are going to be difficult decisions and an economic policy that's not going to work, at least in the short term? And he was right, and they reaped some electoral benefits from that. It was regrettable. And are there things we could have done better? I'm sure there are. A lot has been made of the president's lack of adroitness, I guess is how critics would put it, in dealing with some of the political players in Washington. But I don't think we were I never believed that we were one beer away, one golf game away, one movie in the White House theater away from peace and harmony in Washington. I think there was a strategic decision made to deny the president bipartisan cooperation, and that was the fundamental problem.
Listeners, we're talking to David Axelrod, former senior strategist to President Obama. His new book is called Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. I'd love to ask you about what Republicans are talking about these days, income inequality. Who would have thought it? You know, this traditional Democratic issue. But let's listen to a little bit of tape. Here's Republican Senator Ted Cruz speaking to Fox News recently.
The facts are we're facing right now a divided America when it comes to the economy. It is true that the top 1% are doing great under Barack Obama. Today, the top 1% earn a higher share of our national income than any year since 1928.
So my question, I mean, there's just so much that jumps out at me, but I mean, could you have imagined back in 2007, 2008 that Republicans would be trying to make hay with this argument?
Well, I couldn't even imagine it 2 years ago. I mean, this is a new development, obviously. And actually, I want to take a less cynical view of it. I think it's a positive development. The fact that, you know, Mitt Romney's talking about poverty, Jeb Bush is talking about income inequality, and you just heard Ted Cruz talk about it. Marco Rubio wrote a whole book about the middle class and how we shore up the middle class. At least we're talking about the same thing. There's an acknowledgement that there is a problem in our economy that has to be addressed, and now we can have a big national debate about what the appropriate approach is.
Yeah, I didn't mean to bring it up in a cynical
way.
No,
I'm not suggesting you did.
No, but I mean, the point that I wanted to make to a leading Democratic strategist is, you know, have the Democrats sort of miscalculated in some way in somehow ceding this ground to Republicans?
I don't think Democrats have ceded this ground. I think Republicans have a long way to go to prove their authenticity and their sincerity on this issue. I do think, and I've said this, that the president, if I had been the strategist for the Democrats on Capitol Hill in 2014, I would have wanted the president out there making the speech he made at the State of the Union about a year earlier and defining the fight around this big economic debate. They made a judgment that the president was a political liability. The truth is you can never run away from a president of your own party. So they got all the downside of whatever problems attached to him, but none of the upside of having their most effective spokesperson making this economic case.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned that you wished President Obama had given that State of the Union address a year earlier. We spoke recently to Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern about this. And just to remind listeners, some of the big points in the president's State of the Union address where he talked about sort of the middle class economy spending big on education, childcare, higher taxes on the rich to pay for it. And here's what Congressman Jim McGovern said.
I wish he would have given the State of the Union address he gave just a few weeks ago as his first State of the Union address. In the areas that the president outlined in the State of the Union address, again, investing in affordable childcare, that's a real issue. You know, working families trying to make ends meet, lose sleep at night, wondering where they can get affordable, quality childcare for their kids.
So, David Axelrod, you said you wish he'd given it a year ago, but why didn't he give it even further back when he had a majority in the Senate and a smaller Republican majority?
And
in the
a raging economic crisis in which each day we were reminded that there was a 1 in 3 chance that the American economy could collapse, that we could have a second Great Depression. When we arrived in Washington, we were a triage unit dealing with the greatest economic crisis in 80 years. And honestly, Anthony, we were checking vital signs on the economy every single day and trying to push the buttons to keep the American economy moving forward, to stop this cascading downward. There was a necessary step that we had to take. We had to right the economy before we could plow deeply into these other issues. But even within the context of that, when you look at the composition of the Recovery Act and some of the other things the president did, he expanded the earned income tax credit, expanded child care tax credits, made them refundable so that lower-income workers could take advantage of them, expanded Pell Grants, did a whole range of things to try and help people, even as the major project had to be restoring the economy to health. So I'm sympathetic to Congressman McGovern's restlessness, but let's recognize that the steps the president took, all of which were as unpopular as they were necessary, has put the American economy in a position now where we can have a debate about. You don't hear Republicans talking about job loss and about the things they've been talking about for years because they can't talk about it anymore.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to ask you as well about other criticisms and concerns, again, from the political left that the president has been and his party have been perhaps too close to Wall Street rather than Main Street, associated too closely with the likes of people like Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, bank bailouts rather than a robust liberal agenda to help the middle class and working class folks. Do you think that's fair, unfair? How do you respond
to
those concerns?
First of all, I would say that you should best direct that question to folks on Wall Street who in no shape or form would subscribe to the notion that the president has been too close to them. They've been roundly critical of the president, thought the financial reforms were onerous. They were mad that he talked about fat cat bankers and that he protested some of these huge bonuses. But as for Geithner and Summers, I want to tell you that, we arrived at a time when the economy was collapsing. I think that the steps that we took and that we took largely designed by Geithner to shore up the banking system in a way that allowed us to recover all the taxpayer money, that forced them to take stress tests and recapitalize, add more capital to reduce the risk of future crises. I think the financial reform that Barney Frank helped hammer out. All of these things were important. The Consumer Product Financial Protection Bureau that was modeled after the thing that Elizabeth Warren had been fighting for years and that she helped set up. These are major advances. These are not concessions to Wall Street. And I think both Larry and Tim, in terms of the steps we took to save the economy from collapse, were absolutely essential. So I think the ire of the left is misplaced. And I note that Larry recently wrote the report for CAP, a progressive think tank, about the steps we need to take to shore up the middle class. So I consider him tribune for a lot of things that we need to do to make our economy more progressive.
Well, let me ask you about sort of whether the president has told his story well enough. In the summer of 2012, he spoke to Charlie Rose, and he said that his biggest mistake was not communicating his ideas well enough. Here's what he said.
The mistake of my first couple of years was thinking that this job was just about getting the policy right. And that's important. But, you know, the nature of this office is also to tell a story to the American people that gives them a sense of unity and purpose and optimism, especially during tough times.
So I'm just wondering, you know, given the shellacking that Democrats took in the last election, I mean, do you think that was part of it? That
yeah,
the president
I do.
I spoke about this
in the book, and I think not just the president, but some of us around him take some responsibility for this. We thought, because of the nature of the crisis, that he needed to be out there every day speaking to the actions that were being taken and so on. And in some ways, we instead of making him the narrator for the journey on which we were on, we turned him into sort of an announcer for the government on every government action. And I think we reduced his effectiveness as a communicator and as a storyteller in the way that he suggests. So there's no doubt we could have done better. But in fairness to him and in fairness to us, the nature of the challenges that we faced were such that it was never going to be clear sailing. The filter was never going to be clear, and we were always going to have challenges in that period telling the story we wanted to tell.
Let's take a couple of calls. We're talking to David Axelrod. His book is Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. David Axelrod, of course, strategist for President Barack Obama. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Sharon. Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. And I voted for President Obama. I like him. I just feel that he didn't do enough for the middle class, and I really wish he had done 7 years ago what he's saying now. I think the economy he bailed out was Wall Street's economy, not my economy. None of my friends that lost their jobs or had their houses under for 7 years. The unemployment rate only recently came down, despite all the things that you supposedly did to help the economy. You only helped AIG and Goldman Sachs and all Tim Geithner's friends and Larry Summers' friends. He did nothing for the middle class for the last 7 years.
All right, Steve, you put it on the table. Let's let David respond.
Yeah, well, I have to say one of the first things we did was a substantial middle-class tax cut. We fought for that, took a variety of other steps, the tax credits for child care and other tax credit, college tax credits we put in there, a series of health reform and not just the coverage for people who are uninsured, but the safeguards and protections for people who have insurance, so they can't get abused by their insurance agencies. There was an effort. I think that it didn't go fast enough to help people who were underwater, and ultimately millions were helped by that effort. But I will say this: you can't help the middle class in an economy that's in depression. You cannot do that, and you have to write the economy as a means of helping the middle class. Middle class incomes have begun to come back. We don't see the kind of growth that we want yet, but it is a little facile to say all we did was bail out AIG and the banks. The fact is, the American economy, before the president took office, the quarter before he took office, was contracting by 8.9%, the worst quarter since 1930. It's now growing faster than any economy of the developed economies, and the reason is because the president took the steps. And obviously, the caller wasn't an auto worker who is on the line today, because the president stepped in to save the American auto industry.
I want to just move, because we only have a couple of minutes left, and I would love to ask you a little bit about the future, and that is the next election, 2016. Mm-hmm. Republicans have a large group of potential candidates. The Democrats have, well, Hillary Clinton. And is that healthy for the party?
Well, first of all, you know, we'll see how this unfolds. There may be other people on the ballot. I think what's important for the party is less whether we have whether the Democratic Party has internal struggles, but whether the candidate who becomes the nominee has a compelling, coherent message that speaks to the future and speaks to the issues that your caller just raised, and that I think are fundamental to our future, which is, how do you create an economy in the 21st century where people who work hard can get ahead, where people can get a fair shake, where you're not consigned, where you're not doomed to finish where you start if you're poor? That is the struggle. That is the challenge. And I think for the Democratic Party in particular, we have to have a strong, compelling story to tell about where we want to take the country. And, you know, I don't think it necessarily has to come through internecine warfare, but if Hillary Clinton has such a message, and that's the message she's running on, I think she'll be a strong candidate.
We literally have 10 seconds left, but because you're in Massachusetts, I have to ask you about Senator Elizabeth Warren. There are groups in New Hampshire and Iowa hoping to draft her for a presidential run. She says she doesn't want to, but whether she does or not, where do you see her? What's her role in the Democratic
Party? She's a strong, compelling figure. She's been all over these middle class issues and these issues of fairness for years. And whether she runs or not, she's going to have a big influence on the Democratic platform moving forward.
All right. David Axelrod, former senior advisor to the president and director of the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago. He's the author of a new book, Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. David Axelrod, thank you so much for coming in.
Anthony, thanks for having me.
It was a real pleasure. Stay with us, listeners. Coming up, a third major Boston Museum director announces her resignation. We'll talk about what that means for the local arts community. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.